TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. Questions and Answers, Part 3. When the U.S. rose to world power after World War II, one man had incomparable influence, Alan Dulles, spokesperson and lawyer for Wall Street and the most powerful corporations, including members of the oil cartels. Alan Dulles defined and helped build what became known as the secret government, and within that, the CIA. David Talbot, in his book, The Devil's Chessboard, described how Dulles saw himself and the CIA as above the law, secretly pursuing policies that often stood in clear contradiction to presidential or congressional mandates. You heard in two prior TUC radio programs about Dulles' collusion with Nazi-controlled cartels and German war criminals, and how he targeted foreign leaders for assassination or removal. You also heard about Dulles' role in the aftermath of World War II, where the future relations to the USSR and what became the Cold War are being decided, and when the dismantling of the New Deal began. Here now is the conclusion, the question and answer period, where one issue keeps coming up: how much of the post-war secret state has survived, and how, in many ways, has that secret state become even more powerful today? The audience included well-known writers and activists, among them Daniel Ellsberg. Here is David Talbot. He answers an audience question about Operation Mockingbird.
The gentleman asked, first of all, about Operation Mockingbird, which was the CIA's longstanding secret propaganda campaign to manipulate the media, in part through a network of assets, people they had paid or just worked for the CIA for various reasons. And, under Alan Dulles, it was called the Mighty Wurlitzer Machine. They said they could play the media like an organ. So people like James Jesus Angleton and Cord Meyer, who were top counterintelligence officials under Dulles, were masterful at developing these relations with the media and manipulating the press the way they wanted to, including its coverage of the Warren Report and the JFK assassination. Mm-hmm. So I believe that the CIA, in fact, my new book imprint, I have a new investigative book imprint called Hot Books, and we have a new book called Spooking the News, which is going to take the story forward to the present day. I believe that the CIA still has an operation in which it tries to spin the truth and spin the media. They put a lot of effort into it. I believe that sort of the selective leaking of JFK documents, as we just discussed, that Politico ran with, is an example of that. It's CIA disinformation. So yes, I believe that Operation Mockingbird, if not in fact, if not officially, if not in name, still there's something like it that still operates within the CIA.
I just add to that. Yes, there was Operation Mockingbird, and formally it was terminated. But the problem is much worse than that. It goes back to what you were talking about, this milieu in New York, where the bankers and the lawyers and the heads of the media all belong to the same clubs, all talk to each other, and have this Council on Foreign Relations as part of it. So it would exist even without Operation Mockingbird.
Absolutely. That's important to say.
I do like the quote from somebody in the CIA who said, you could get a good journalist for less than a good call girl. And finally, there was a second part to the question, which was about the Church Committee. And you raised the issue a little while back, whether, it was Senator Church's formulation, is the CIA a loyal part of the government, or is it rogue? And I think by formulating the question that way, Senator Church, much as I admire him, it's a sign that he didn't realize the depth of the problem. Because, no, the CIA is not a rogue. It doesn't obey the White House. it is in tune and consults regularly with, what shall we say, Wall Street. It doesn't do things all off by itself. It represents what I call the deep state, the establishment deep state, to the detriment of the people who have been elected to be president in the White House. And that's the nature of the problem, I think.
I completely concur with that. And I think that's what the great value of Peter's work is, following in the footsteps, as I write about, C. Wright Mills, great Columbia sociologist in the 1950s who wrote The Power Elite, and his attempts to understand how American power really worked behind the scenes. I think it's essential for all Americans to try and get behind the curtain, so to speak, and understand the true mechanics of American power. And Peter has done, obviously just the best work, I think, of any living scholar in that area. And that's the crux of my book, is trying to understand how the deep state in the form of Alan Dulles and his circle were operating behind the scenes throughout these presidencies that we've been discussing today to pursue the interests of a corporate class, of a financial class, and not America's interests.
Could I just add a word? Because you and I both owe a great debt to C. Wright Mills. The book, by the way, has some extraordinary, just perfect quotes from C. Wright Mills that apply exactly to where we are now. I like the quote about how the American system of organized irresponsibility, and I think with all these corporations financing research that proves that there's no climate problem.
Or how about this one? He says, quote, I hope I get the quote right, "For the first time in history, we see men in power talking about an emergency without foreseeable end." This is what he calls crackpot realism. In the name of realism, we have men in authority creating a paranoid reality all of their own, end quote. And that's, of course, this paranoid reality that we continue to live in during the era of the war on terror.
But I'd like to ask you a question about this, because in the 50s, what C. Wright Mills saw and wrote about was what he called a power elite, which was composed of corporate executives, the military establishment, and a political directorate, all on the same page.
He didn't know about Dulles and the CIA yet.
Well, that's it. And he actually wrote in 58, much of what was once called the invisible government, that's a word for the phrase for the CIA, is now part of the quite visible government. But in my analysis, I see, ever since the Bay of Pigs, I see great tension between the state and the invisible government, or I would say the deep state, the structural or beltway deep state, CIA, NSA, between the laws of the country and these secret organizations that do not feel bound by the law and can get away with it because they do everything in secret. So I'd like you to comment on whether you think...
And C. Wright Mills also understood, although you're right, he didn't go deep enough to understanding that sort of intelligence complex and the way it was becoming a major force of its own. But he did understand how terror and security threats could be exploited. And he was beginning to talk about that during the Cold War in a way that I think is even more relevant today. That gives enormous power, as we see every day, to these forces, these anti-democratic forces in our country. They're allowed to get away literally with murder whenever we go into orange or red alert. And so this is this syndrome that the country is locked into at this point that really we have to start now, 15 years into the war on terror, beginning to deconstruct and understand and push back against.
So, question. Yep.
Yes, David, I'd like to go back to World War II. In your book, you mentioned a number of times about the Bank for International Settlements, and Alan Dulles was in Bern, and the Bank for International Settlements continued to meet in Rougemont near Gstaad during the war and socialized the Japanese, the Germans, the Italians, all socialized with their wives. How implemented is Alan Dulles in moving the Nazi gold around through the Bank of International Settlements to
finance?
Well, he's
key. It's a great question. You asked about the Bank of International Settlements, which was a key institution, the key Nazi financial institution during World War II. So the Bank of International Settlements is this obscure institution that goes back to the post-World War I days when it was set up by the central banks of Europe and the United States to administer German reparations payments after World War I. And it kind of morphs into a Nazi bank by the war, World War II.
With an American president.
With an American president, strangely. Thomas McKittrick, who's a very close friend of Dulles. And so Thomas McKittrick is seen as basically a traitor, as a treasonous agent by the Roosevelt administration. And when he comes home from Switzerland to visit and is feted by his corporate friends, the Waldorf Astoria or some party, the University Club, they basically try to arrest him, the Roosevelt administration, and keep him in the U.S.
Treasury Department.
The Treasury Department, Henry Morgenthau again. Again, the Dulles brothers ride to his rescue. Alan Dulles pulls strings, and a few months later, McKittrick is back in Switzerland, and he's, you know, venting about, oh, these fellows in the Roosevelt administration, they don't like me because I talk to the Germans and Italians. I happen to say that the Germans and Italians are fine fellows. I mean, he literally had no moral compass, these
and
people.
And didn't he talk about the mean types in the Treasury Department?
Exactly, that they were harassing him and so on. So, yeah, the Bank of International Settlements, a very key institution. It did indeed launder Nazi treasure. In fact, as the head of the Reichsbank said, it was the only overseas financial mechanism that the Nazis had during the war.
So after the war, you have Bretton Woods, which is the designing of the post-war international financial establishment. And there's a man there called Harry Dexter White representing the U.S. Treasury. And it's somebody's going to have to go, either McKittrick or White. And I believe that the first meeting at Bretton Woods, they passed a resolution to dissolve the BIS. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And you have a phrase. I was going to ask this question before, but I'm definitely going to ask it now. I'm going to quote from your book. If the political winds, this, by the way, we're talking now about 1948. It's the period when Alger Hiss has been called before the House Un-American Activities Committee, where Richard Nixon is acting after conferring with Alan Dulles. And much more important than Alger Hiss is the fact that they are grilling and intend to grill again Harry Dexter White, the architect of the plan which would have done away with the BIS.
He was the architect of not only the IMF and the World Bank, along with John Maynard Keynes, but also he was the architect of a New Deal vision for a post-war international order, a post-war international order that he saw incorporating the Soviet Union as a mechanism of world peace. Because he thought if you could incorporate the Soviet Union into your post-war financial order, that would be a huge mitigator against another war, World War III. It was an incredible vision, and of course he had to be witch-hunted. And that's what they did to him.
And this is what you write. If the political winds had been blowing in a different direction in 1948, it might have well have been men like Foster and Alan Dulles, Thomas McKittrick of the BIS, and now two names we haven't heard yet, Walter Teagle and William Stamps Farish of Standard Oil, instead of new dealers like Hiss and White, who were put under the investigative spotlight for treason. Now, I'll just say parenthetically that during the war, Harry Truman was a senator investigating the national defense effort, and he called up these two men you're hearing about from Standard Oil. And as a result of his testimony, Farish was actually fined $1,000 and Standard Oil was fined $50,000 because they were hindering the production of artificial rubber in America for the war effort.
And diesel engines.
And diesel engines because they had a patent agreement with IG Farben in Germany, which was running the slave camps in Auschwitz. And
so let me just jump in. I had to say to underline this point for me, because I think this is one of the big takeaways of tonight. You have to, I think, leave at least pondering this question: the enormous extent of the complicity between this deep state, this American deep state, as Peter calls it, or I call the secret government, this corporate, financial, military nexus of power, and the Nazi regime. I mean, to me, that has not been fully told. In all the Steven Spielberg sort of soft focus stories of Tom Hanks, of World War II and all that, or, you know, George Clooney did the one about the looting of the art treasure and so on. We never get to that level where we understand that this was an ideological war within this country, within the ruling class, so to speak, of our own country. You had the forces in the Roosevelt administration, Morgenthau and so on, and Roosevelt himself, who were dead set against this complicity and were trying to root it out, and were trying to actually bring some of these men, even during the war itself, to trial. And yet they were being, you know, strongly resisted by this other faction of American power. And that other faction of American power did indeed take control of the country after World War II. So basically we're saying Nazi collaborators took over the country after World War II.
Right. Well, I just want to quote from Senator Harry Truman before, or maybe it was right after, Teagle and Farish from Standard Oil came to his committee. He said, "I think this approaches treason." So what you're saying that they could have been tried for treason, you have the authority of Senator Truman behind him. And Roosevelt, I think, knew what he was doing.
And Arthur Goldberg, who the future Supreme Court Justice, who served with the Dulles in the OSS, also later said both Dulles brothers should have been put on trial for treason because of their activity during World War II.
But this goes back to the control of the media. The media were initially very favorable to Hiss. Hiss became a victim of this great war for...
And Harry Dexter White, this economic visionary, he was on the level of a Keynes. And he, under stress, was harassed by Hugh Ack, I believe,
yes,
by the House on American Activities Committee, by the FBI, and he ended up having a heart attack and dying in the midst of all this.
That is a long treatment of the Hiss case in the book, which is really about this struggle between two alternative visions for America.
For America in the post-war.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
So, fascinating talk. Thank you very much. Also very scary. Given where we are today, with media spin, with polarization, with some people wanting us to believe that we're in a war of civilizations in this world, what advice would you give to us to affect positive change?
Well, you know, I think he doesn't want to be put on the spot, but I would like to throw this to Dan Ellsberg, if Dan would just offer it. No, okay. But speaking for Dan, I think we have to, number one, be inspired by people like Edward Snowden, Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, people who've put their lives on the line to wake up the American people and the people of the world about the enormous growth of this surveillance state, of this national security state, and how it's undermined and sabotaged democracy throughout the world. So that's number one. Support those people who have, you know, sacrificed for us already, and fight for them legally and politically, and try to get them released. And I think, you know, in the process of doing that, as happened with Dan Ellsberg's case, the Pentagon Papers case, you know, during the Vietnam War, that mobilized a lot of consciousness around the war and the illegality of the war. And I think was a very important turning point in many ways. And Dan ultimately legally triumphed. So that's number one. You know, we need to sort of rally around our heroes. And those people, those three people are heroes. Number two, I think we got to get organized again. I mean, I grew up during the Vietnam War. You know, we had mass movement. We had organizations. We had people in the streets. I mean, there's nothing like that now. There was a spasm of sort of international popular, you know, ferment around the invasion of Iraq. And when that, you know, unfortunately didn't succeed, it seemed like we went back into slumber mode. I know there's been moments when, you know, that's not been true, and that we have sort of gotten our act together again. But I think it's all on all of us as American citizens at this point. You know, I mean, the country is spiraling, I think, politically out of control, frankly. I'm incredibly appalled by the 2016 presidential campaign at this point. We can laugh about it, but it really is scarier than that. And when you have these presidential candidates like Trump reveling and luxuriating in this, I think, fascistic rhetoric and racist rhetoric and the most obscene intolerance, that permits then all sorts of lunacy to get unhinged in this country. And believe me, I think America at this point, given all the stress that the American people are under, the economic stress, the constant war, the constant militarization of our psyches, I mean, that American Sniper is this movie that becomes our sort of, that's our American hero. I mean, this country, as Martin Luther King said many years ago, is in mortal danger of losing its soul at this point, more than ever in my lifetime. So we have to, you know, I think, organize. We have to run people for office. We have to take back the country. We have to confront these people. You know, when Occupy happened, I was at Zuccotti Park with my friend Karen Croft, who was an essential part, by the way, of this book. And the reason why I was able to do the book as effectively as I did was in large part because of Karen, who has been my research partner in crime on all my books. But Karen and I happened to be in New York. We went down to Zuccotti Park that first weekend, and it was an amazing experience because there was a sense that Americans were finally going, enough. You've screwed us financially. You've taken away, you know, my homes. You've taken away my job, and enough. We're fighting back now. And it was all kinds of people. It wasn't just kids that first weekend. It was middle-aged people with their babies. It was people who had just lost their homes, middle-class people. It was an amazing collection of people, an amazing moment, I think, for this country. But that movement didn't organize well enough because of its anarchistic sort of, you know, utopianism and all that. And I think we have to learn from that. But what I did learn from that was how scared the powers that be became just with that one spasm of democracy in the streets. Look, if Occupy can scare them, we know actually how possible it is to put the fear of God in these people and to start to push back. We did it during the 30s. We did it during the New Deal. We can do it. We did it during Vietnam and the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement. The Black Lives Movement, I think, is an enormous inspiration for all of us that these young people are finally saying, enough. You can't kill us and get away with it anymore. You can't keep killing young Black people in this country and get away with it. And so, you know, to me, that's another 1960s moment. It's another civil rights moment. It's within our power to really get our act together.
I do want to applaud what you just said, and particularly you point out that America has phases and that there have been phases of organization, and the last one, which most of people here, I think, remember, was the 60s. But in my book, The American Deep State, which addresses exactly this problem, I think something has to happen before we can have this kind of organization. We have to demilitarize Homeland Security, and in general, go back to the Mills quote about how we're now in a permanent state of emergency. That wasn't metaphorical. Truman had declared an emergency in the Korean War, and it wasn't repealed until the Church Committee discovered it in 1975, I think. Well, how many of you know we're back in a state of emergency? It was declared on the 14th of September, 2001. There were two emergencies declared, and I have a lot to say about this in my book. They have to be repealed because you go out, if you're at all successful with any kind of demonstration now, what happens? A militarized police force comes and beats you unconscious. Against the statutes of the United States, because there is an emergency, we have a permanent U.S. brigade stationed permanently to deal with any protest that gets out of control.
And it's happening in Paris with the climate change protesters.
Right.
And that's being militarized, too, and they're being rounded up and being put under house arrest.
I want to be very specific, and I've been saying this for about 6 years and hasn't got anywhere, but I'm still going to say it. We have to get rid of that emergency. We have to find out what so-called continuity of government provisions are still in force, and we know that there are some because some of them were put in by President Bush in 2007.
And how many people know about continuity of government, what that means? These authoritarian measures?
Not very many. Well, I'm going to make a plug for my book.
Quick, go ahead. Quickly give us that explanation.
Well, yeah, I think this is worth going into. This goes back to, really, again, Truman and the Korean War. If you're going to use atomic threats, which Koreans did, you have to plan for atomic retaliation. And they set in motion a series of plannings for continuity of government in the event of an atomic attack. And they can be summed up, as they were in the mid-80s, by the phrase suspension of the U.S. Constitution. And basically, there are three. Warrantless surveillance, you know all about. Warrantless detention, you may not be aware that more than 1,000 Muslims were rounded up after 9/11 and detained without any charges and eventually let go. I talked to one of them. He was a Shia from Iran. Certainly he had nothing to do with the hijackers. He was beaten so badly there was blood in his urine, and he's been told never to go public with this. I met him at an academic memorial service. And the third one was, originally they said martial law, but it's become instead militarization of homeland security. We have that now. We have a U.S. command, military command, NORTHCOM, that oversees the United States the way SOUTHCOM oversees South America and CENTCOM oversees Central Asia. And that was done without most Americans even knowing about it. I'll ask you, how many of you knew there is now a NORTHCOM? You see, that is how far we are with the media don't talk about it. What happened under Reagan was they changed the planning for being for an atomic attack, for being for any emergency. And it is a fact recorded in the 9/11.
And the media is militarized, too. I mean, all you have to do is look at the coverage on MSNBC, even the liberal alternative on cable, at the coverage of Paris. One ex-military, one ex-intelligence guy after the next, all calling for what? How to respond? More blood, more mobilization, more surveillance. I mean, that's what happens 24/7 now in the American media after every kind of spasm of fear. So, I mean, you know, it's now, I think, the whole society has to be thoroughly, I think, you know, cleansed in some way of this kind of militarization of our consciousness.
Well, with that, I'm going to thank David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott for this incredibly inspiring and provocative evening.
That's Laura Shepherd bringing to conclusion the conversation between David Talbot, author of the 2015 book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government, and Peter Dale Scott, author of The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. She moderated the question and answer period at the December 2, 2015 meeting at the Mechanics Institute Library. Laura Shepherd is the Director of Events at the 160-plus-year-old Mechanics Institute in San Francisco. Thanks to the staff of the Institute for this excellent recording. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.